And money is the focus of official Washington as the 116th Congress prepares to adjourn. Several separate conversations and deals are being debated on the Hill as both another COVID relief bill and a federal budget are on the table. Good evening and thanks for joining us on Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio this Wednesday, December the 9th. I'm Peter Slynn. In other Washington news, Lloyd Austin has been named as Joe Biden's choice for Secretary of Defense. Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell of California is being accused of being close to a known Chinese spy. Former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe announced he's running to be governor of the Commonwealth again. And late this afternoon, the federal government and 48 states sued Facebook over antitrust concerns. But we'll begin tonight with the money. No deals have been completed, but separate negotiations are taking place on three fronts: a new COVID relief plan, a one-week continuing resolution to keep the federal government open past this Friday, which passed the House today, and a general federal budget for the fiscal year 2021. In the House, two members, Democrat Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut and Republican Kay Granger of Texas, voiced their views on aspects of federal spending. We'll start with Rosa DeLauro.
The continuing resolution we consider today will keep the government up and running to bring spending talks to a successful conclusion. These are serious issues that touch every aspect of people's lives, like their education, transportation systems, national security, public health infrastructure, and our environment. In addition to an omnibus appropriations bill, it is my hope that this additional week will allow negotiators the time to assemble an emergency coronavirus relief package, to take advantage of this window of opportunity, that Leader McConnell finally sit down with Democrats to find a bipartisan solution. Coupled with a full year of government funding, an interim emergency coronavirus relief package is critical. It is a lifeline for working families. If we do not act, 12 million Americans could lose unemployment aid just after Christmas. Millions access to paid sick leave and protections against evictions. This will put working families over the edge and our economy closer to the financial cliff. I urge my colleagues to join me in adopting this continuing resolution. Let us support the ongoing negotiations. People are desperate. They are counting on us. We need to provide relief to working families, to our schools, to our children, to small businesses and communities across the nation.
And that was Connecticut Democrat Rosa DeLauro earlier today on the House floor. She was followed by Republican Kay Granger of Texas.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today in support of H.R. 8900, a continuing resolution that will fund the government through December the 18th. Members of the Appropriations Committee have been negotiating night and day for weeks to reach agreement on a full-year appropriation bill. At the same time, House and Senate leaders continue to discuss a coronavirus relief package with the administration. It's my hope that we can complete both of these important pieces of legislation as soon as possible. There is so much at stake: our national security, the health and welfare of millions of Americans, and our economic recovery. Passing this one-week CR is simply a stopgap measure. I expect we will be back on the floor next week to complete the year's work. I urge my colleagues to join me in voting in favor of this continuing resolution so that the Senate can pass it and send it to the President for signature. Then we must immediately get back to the important work the American people expect of us to finish.
And that was Representative Kay Granger, a Republican of Texas, talking about the one-week continuing resolution, which passed the House today. Congressman Andy Harris is the only Republican in the Maryland congressional delegation. He represents the Eastern Shore of Maryland. He's a member of the Appropriations Committee. Congressman Harris, where are you when it comes to corona relief funding?
Well, I think that the Senate package that they looked at really over a month ago is the one that we should have had in place already. I think that that's what we need to do. I also believe that we need some liability protection for our businesses and our physicians who have have taken care of the public during this pandemic. And I would hope that could be added in, but I understand that's controversial.
How is your district handling coronavirus?
Well, you know, we were spared a lot of it. Our hospital systems are not, stressed to their limit. So we've done fairly well. I think most of the businesses this summer, unfortunately, suffered because we are, the Eastern Shore of Maryland is a seasonal economy to some extent. We're hoping the next summer is better. We think, I fully believe that the vaccines will get us there. Some of the therapeutics that are coming out will make it a much easier year next year than this year.
Now, some of the proposals for corona relief in this latest package include direct payments. Do you support that?
You know, I support the unemployment. I think that we should have the unemployment benefit extension. I think it should be a $300 a week federal supplement, as was in the Senate bill. I think the $600 per week, unfortunately, created a disincentive for some of the unemployed to go back to work when jobs did become available in the late summer and fall. But I'm not sure that we need direct payments. I think they should be targeted payments, targeted at the people who need relief. You know, I know that there are people who have – who had a continued paycheck. For instance, almost all federal government employees have had a continuous paycheck. So I'm not sure, why people who have not suffered as much should get, a payment that everybody else gets. We should have targeted relief. I believe it should be a $300 a week federal unemployment supplement with extension, of course, of federal unemployment benefits.
Now, along with this corona relief bill that's being discussed, there's the federal budget for FY 2021. As a member of the Appropriations Committee, what are you hearing? What are you seeing?
Well, this is going to be a strange year. Obviously, coronavirus has thrown a monkey wrench into a lot of things. I do know we have a two-year budget deal that we're supposed to be holding to. I would hope that if we were going to break those, what we call the budget caps, the second year of the budget caps, that, we take action as a body to decide to break them. But in the absence of voting to break those budget caps, we should try to adhere to that the best we can. Because honestly, we should be providing for COVID relief, as we have been in emergency appropriations, supplemental appropriations packages. But I think we should adhere to the budget caps for our regular appropriations package.
Do you see more bipartisanship in the next Congress now that the numbers between Democrats and Republicans will be narrowed?
Well, I think it's going to be forced on us. To be honest, it looks like, at best, I think the Democrats will have a 5-7 seat margin. When you have 10 members who are coming back on the other side of the aisle who actually voted against the current speaker last time, I mean, you pretty clearly have a group of Democrats and Republicans in the center who I think are going to work much more closely together to form a working majority. This empowers what we used to call the blue dog Democrats to, I think, have a more of an influence on policy coming out of the majority.
Will there be more focus, do you think, on fiscal matters in the next Congress?
Well, we're not over the COVID pandemic. I think the focus should be on making sure we wind this pandemic down adequately, that we spend the money we need to come up with the therapeutics, distribute the vaccines, and then plan for future pandemics. Obviously, we should keep finances in the back of our mind at all times, but now is probably not the time to put that as the main. The main focus has to remain getting over this pandemic, getting our economy back on track.
Congressman Andy Harris is a Republican from Maryland, and we appreciate your spending a few minutes with us on C-SPAN Radio.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. Now, this morning on CNN, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar laid out the distribution plan for COVID-19 vaccines.
So we have the Pfizer Advisory Committee tomorrow, a completely public process. And then if everything is on track, it could be a matter of days, then FDA approves the vaccine. We would then authorize shipment within 24 hours. It would literally go, this Pfizer vaccine, they're shipping directly. It would go by FedEx and UPS, directly shipped to wherever the governors have told us they want it to go. So some governors are leveraging the system we set up, CVS and Walgreens, especially for their nursing homes. The initial focus is going to be healthcare workers and nursing home patients. So CVS and Walgreens are going to do almost 100% of the nursing homes in America. So that's a turnkey operation. But then they'll also be shipping to hospitals where they'll do mass vaccination campaigns of their healthcare workers. 20 million people should get vaccinated in just the next several weeks. And then we'll just keep rolling out vaccines through January, February, March as they come off the production lines.
And what month do you expect right now average Americans, meaning the general public, to get vaccinated or to have it available to them?
So that's going to be up to the nation's governors as they prioritize within their states. But as we look at the quantities of vaccine that we expect to come off from a multitude of manufacturers, you should start seeing at points in February and March general population vaccinations occurring. What we've said is we expect that in the second quarter of next year, we'd have enough vaccine for all Americans that want it. But that's not a moment in time event. As more vaccine becomes available, as we perhaps see AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson join the ranks, more will be available and our governors will keep opening it up. And we'll start seeing general vaccination campaigns also, especially the medically underserved and most vulnerable.
But February and March is before second quarter. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that there could even be a speedier timeline for the general public.
Sure. We'll start seeing. You know, we might see 5 million, 10 million, 20 million doses coming out per week, and the governors will decide how to prioritize and get that out there. But eventually, the image you want to see, and this is what we did in the summit yesterday that the president hosted with our CVS, Walgreens, FedEx, UPS, McKesson, and our bipartisan group of governors, we want to replicate the experience you have for the flu vaccine. We want it convenient to you. Use a tried-and-true system that we do hundreds of millions of vaccines through every year. So that's really the backbone of the approach that we're taking.
And that was Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar earlier today on CNN. Now, Canada became the third country to approve the first COVID-19 vaccine. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has also been approved in the UK and Bahrain. And on the Senate floor today, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell disagreed with the Democrats' refusal to accept a new $900 billion plus COVID deal offered by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and the White House. Here's the majority leader.
I suggested both sides drop what seemed to be the most controversial demand in the eyes of our counterparts. Democrats continue to oppose common sense legal protections that university presidents have been begging for, and Republicans see no need to send huge sums of money to state and local governments whose tax revenues have actually gone up. Negotiating 101 suggests we set those two controversial pieces aside and plow ahead with a huge pile of things that we agree on. But that would require both sides to truly want to get an outcome. Just hours after Democrats poured cold water on that, Secretary Mnuchin tried another new tack and sent over an offer. And in a bizarre and schizophrenic press release, the Speaker and the leader said the administration was obstructing negotiations by negotiating. Two more brush-offs in about 2 hours. More deflection, more delay, and more suffering for innocent Americans. Can anyone point to a single sign, from April through now, that Democratic leaders have seriously wanted another bipartisan deal to become law? Can anybody name one way, just one, the Democratic leaders would have behaved differently if their singular goal was to kill any compromise? That hypothetical world looks suspiciously like the world we've been living in. Think of it. We have a Speaker of the House from San Francisco who has spent months ensuring that unemployed Californians can't have jobless aid extended, and California restaurants can't get another round of PPP, unless the governor of California gets a federal slush fund out of proportion to any proven need. The working families agree they should not get any more help themselves unless the governors and state legislatures get a controversial bailout. Are struggling Americans saying, thank goodness the Democrats are bravely blocking help for me and my family unless my state politicians get some more cash? I'd say not. Our people need more help.
And that was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell earlier today. And Senate Minority Whip Dick Durbin also took to the Senate floor to discuss his views on COVID and liability insurance. Here's a portion of his remarks.
There's an issue that still is unresolved, and it's the issue of liability. We don't know what to do with that, but we ought to look at the evidence. So far in this calendar year, with 15 million people infected with COVID-19, fewer than three lawsuits per state, have been filed in medical malpractice or personal injury claims. There are a lot of other lawsuits between businesses and with insurance companies by prisoners in jail saying that their confinement is dangerous to their health, people filing lawsuits against governors for issuing orders to stay at home and close down businesses. But when it comes to the personal injury claims, there are very few, very few. We know why, those of us who've been involved in the practice of law. One of the things that you have to prove to recover in a case is causation. That is rare in a case dealing with coronavirus, to be able to pinpoint exactly when you became infected and what the circumstances are. That's why so few lawsuits have been filed. Senator from Kentucky is insisting that there be immunity to liability as part of any agreement. It is a thorny topic, a difficult topic, a controversial topic, but I plead with him to hold to another day the overall issue of liability. Accept this emergency bill that we have put together as a bipartisan group of senators to address this issue in the reality of the world that we live. To hold it back because of some other major issue that has not been resolved is unfair to American families and workers and students and health workers. We owe it to them to do everything in our power to help them now. How can we, in good conscience, go home for Christmas knowing that the day after Christmas, 12 million Americans will see their unemployment insurance disappear because of our inability to act? What kind of spirit is that of any holiday season?
And now joining us on Washington Today is Washington Post economics reporter Jeff Stein. Mr. Stein, help us break down some of these avenues of spending that are currently being debated on Capitol Hill. Let's begin with the one-week extension. Where are we on that?
We are expecting lawmakers to today in the House approve legislation to fund the government for just one additional week. With no action, the government would shut down on Saturday. This will avert that, and the idea is they can do that to give appropriators a little bit more time to hammer out a budget agreement and for congressional leaders to reach a deal on potential economic relief, you know, stimulus support for the economy as well.
And that 1 week extension would be at the same funding levels as currently we're operating under currently. The House is due to vote on that. We're taping this at 3 p.m. The House is due to vote on that at about 3:30 this afternoon, presumably will pass. When will we see it in the Senate, and what are its prospects?
The Senate is going to pass that very quickly. We expect it to pass tomorrow. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already indicated that he will quickly approve that measure. There is no appetite for shutting down the government right now, fortunately. That said, if we are into next week after that one-week measure passes and they are still apart on either the budget or the stimulus, things could get very hairy very quickly. A lot of lawmakers have said this, you know, this is the train leaving the station. We need tons of economic support and other relief efforts for this very scary and dangerous situation we find ourselves in. And people will be pushing to make sure that that gets attached to this must-pass government budget deal that we've been discussing.
So how much money are we talking about when we're talking about fiscal year 2021?
For the appropriation side?
Yes, for the budget for the year.
We're looking at $1.4 trillion for that budget. And it seems like there's only a few outstanding controversial items, but that they're pretty close to an agreement. Typically, we're looking at immigration funding being the biggest sticking point, and the appropriators continue to disagree about the number of detention beds and the amount of money for President Trump's border wall.
And then we get into the COVID relief bill. Mr. Stein, do you know offhand how much we've spent already on COVID relief, and where is the, what is the status of this current bill?
So far, we've spent a little more than $3 trillion, which is, needless to say, a tremendous amount of money. It's something close to 15% of America's gross domestic product annually. The current bill being discussed, there's a couple different things going on. There's two separate tracks, and it's important to keep these separate. There's the track of this bipartisan group of senators led by Senator Joe Manchin, Mark Warner, Republicans Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Bill Cassidy. They are trying to reach an agreement among themselves, this centrist group of lawmakers. Separately, leadership, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, they've been somewhat talking and exchanging offers, although the prospects for that kind of agreement do not look good right now. The White House released an offer last night that is a clear non-starter among Democrats. It has the support of McConnell and McCarthy, at least ostensibly. But that offer does not include nearly sufficient unemployment benefits for what Democrats want and is unlikely to proceed.
And what about stimulus checks directly to the American people?
The thing with stimulus checks is that they were excluded from the bipartisan efforts led by Manchin and Romney that I mentioned too. The reason those were excluded from that effort is because really the stimulus checks, while a top priority for many lawmakers, is not really the top priority for either party. Republicans are primarily insistent on another round of small business loans, PPP money, and Democrats are insistent on aid to the unemployed and money for state and local governments, but Republicans have also insisted that the package be under $1 trillion. And so when you add those three elements up together, there's not a lot of room for the stimulus checks, which are quite expensive. And the Mnuchin proposal, the White House proposal that was submitted to Democrats last night, does include a stimulus check of $600 per person, but that comes in the White House proposal at the expense of unemployment benefits, which I think for a lot of people is a bad idea, because the unemployment benefits obviously more directly target those who have been most hurt by the pandemic. The stimulus checks go to everyone regardless of, you know, below an income threshold, but it's not as targeted for those in desperate need of help.
Now, Jeff Stein of The Washington Post, yesterday, Majority Leader McConnell proposed eliminating the liability issues and the state and local government funding from any stimulus bill. Where did that go?
Well, nowhere pretty fast. Democrats say that state and local governments are heading towards a budget catastrophe, and Democrats are not going to be willing to save businesses across the country if it means that, you know, major cities are forced to lay off thousands of transit workers, thousands of teachers, and so on and so forth. So that idea of McConnell, it makes a degree of sense, because he's saying, look, why don't we just, you know, lawmakers have been hung up for months on the liability shield for businesses and the state and local money. Democrats want the state and local money, but Republicans object. Republicans want the liability shield and Democrats object. So McConnell said, what if we just leave those aside, pass everything else, and then move on? And but from Democrats' perspective, any package that lets states and cities hemorrhage money is a no-go.
Do you foresee this COVID relief package being passed as separate legislation or attached perhaps to the 2021 budget?
It's a really good question. We've heard all kinds of speculation about where that might go, and my magic eight ball is cloudy at the moment, unfortunately. But, you know, I think, frankly, the odds of Congress being able to come back after this round of sort of must-pass government spending legislation and do something serious after that looks pretty slim to me. So I think it's pretty possible that we see Democrats be willing to take small measures as part of the must-pass government spending bill and push for it later. But that, who knows if that will actually materialize.
And have we gotten indications from the White House whether or not President Trump will sign all these pieces of legislation that we've just discussed?
you know, it sounds like it, and the sources I've talked to in the White House think that he would be on board as sort of an economic legacy situation. But, you know, I remember being on radio programs and being asked this question about previous government spending deals, and then at the last minute, Trump will insist on this provision or that provision and blow the whole thing up. Obviously, we had the longest shutdown in government history under this president, and there would be even more damaging now, given that we're in the middle of a pandemic. But it does not seem inconceivable to me that Trump could again change his mind at the last minute, as he has multiple times in the past.
Jeff Stein with The Washington Post, thanks for the update.
Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. And welcome back. This is Washington Today for December 9th, 2020. I'm Peter Slim. Now, late this afternoon, the Biden-Harris transition team released a statement today on Hunter Biden. It reads, quote, "I learned yesterday for the first time that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Delaware advised my legal counsel, also yesterday, that they are investigating my tax affairs. I take this matter very seriously, but I am confident that a professional and objective review of these matters will demonstrate that I handled my affairs legally and appropriately, including with the benefit of professional tax advisors." That statement was attributed to Hunter Biden. And then the statement from the Biden-Harris transition team followed, quote, President-elect Biden is deeply proud of his son, who has fought through difficult challenges, including the vicious personal attacks of recent months, only to emerge stronger," end quote. We'll have more on this story as it develops. Now, in other presidential transition news, President-elect Biden officially introduced retired Army General Lloyd Austin to be his Secretary of Defense. This is in Wilmington, Delaware. Here's President-elect Biden.
So today, I'm honored to nominate former General Lloyd Austin as the 28th Secretary of Defense. I want to thank you, General. You're a friend, but I want to thank you, General Austin, for once more stepping forward to serve your nation. This is not a post he sought, but I sought him. And I want to thank you and your family for once again sharing you with our country. And thanks, Charlene. Today, I know how proud all of they all are of you, all four of your children, your older sisters, and your brother. I knew the reason why you were a good man, you had to have sisters to raise you along the way, right? I know mine did me, and she's much younger. And your incredible wife, Charlene, and I mean that sincerely. Tomorrow, I'm told that Jill and Charlene are going to spend some time together sending off packages to our soldiers abroad. She and Jill are both passionate about supporting military spouses and families, and I know they'll be a powerful advocates for that community together. And, you know, they're going to both be working at the White House and the Defense Department together to make sure our families are okay. As I said before, General, America only has many obligations, one sacred obligation, to care and equip those we send to war, care for their families when they're gone, and to care for them when they come home and their families. I got to know General Austin during my early days as Vice President. President Obama had charged me with overseeing the end of Operation Iraqi Freedom and ensuring the orderly withdrawal of our forces and equipment from Iraq. General Austin was with me on the ground, not just for meetings with troops or for military strategy sessions. He was there when I was working with Iraq political leaders. I watched his political skill, how he dealt with them. They respected him across the board. When I met with the leaders of our coalition partners, the same thing. And he was there during one particularly memorable incident when we were at a meeting at the ambassador's residence in the Green Zone. The insurgents launched a rocket attack on the house. And of course, General Austin, it was just another day at the office. He just sat there and kept right on going. So I sat there and kept right on going. And everyone wondered, what in the hell are they doing? But, you know, he's cool under fire, inspiring the same and all those around him. That's Lloyd Austin.
And that was President-elect Joe Biden earlier today in Delaware. Now, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in Georgia today discussed his view of the danger China poses to both security and free speech on U.S. college campuses. From Georgia Tech, here's Secretary Mike Pompeo.
The lesson I think that we can take away from this is clear. It's that the Chinese Communist Party wants what we have, and they will do whatever they must do to take it and get it. They will steal our stuff. They will pressure critics of the Chinese Communist Party to keep quiet. They will do whatever it takes. And it's important to come and talk with the American people about this, because Americans must know how the Chinese Communist Party is poisoning the well of our higher education institutions for its own ends, and how those actions degrade our freedoms and American national security. If we don't educate ourselves, if we're not honest about what's taking place, we'll get schooled by Beijing. Now, it's taken this country and indeed the entire free world a long time to understand the trajectory that China is on today. In fact, we're not quite there yet everywhere in the world. There's no one to hold accountable for this. That's not the important part. Because for a long time, Republicans, Democrats, leaders all across academia, institutions, commercial space, thought that by trading and engaging with China, that the Chinese Communist Party would reform itself, it would loosen up, it would embrace economic and political freedom, and it would present less risk to freedom around the world. But instead, that's not what we got. Instead, the Chinese Communists used the wealth that was created by this to tighten their grip on power, their grip on power over the Chinese people, and to build a high-tech, repressive state like the world has never seen. General Secretary Xi Jinping has made clear his intentions. You only have to listen to what he says. He says he wants total control at home and to make China the number one power abroad. And he's well on his way to working on that project. He's building up the People's Liberation Army. He's manipulating international organizations for Beijing's benefit. And he's engaging, as we have seen in TV only just these last 2 days, he's engaging in a vast influence campaign all across the world.
And that was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at Georgia Tech earlier today. His remarks came as there are reports that a Chinese spy had contact with Representative Eric Swalwell, Democrat of California. According to the publication Axios, quote, a suspected Chinese intelligence operative developed extensive ties with local and national politicians, including a U.S. congressman, in what U.S. officials believe was a political intelligence operation run by China's main civilian spy agency between 2011 and 2015, Axios found in a year-long investigation. Representative Swalwell's office told Axios, quote, Representative Swalwell, long ago, provided information about this person, whom he met more than 8 years ago and whom he hasn't seen in nearly 6 years, to the FBI. To protect information that might be classified, he will not participate in your story, end quote. To find out more on this story, you can go to Axios.com. Now, also today, former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe announced in Richmond that he is seeking a second term as governor. From earlier today, here's former Governor Terry McAuliffe.
We've stepped up to the plate. We've been bold. We have taken actions that will move our Commonwealth forward. This pandemic has given us big, tremendous challenges. But folks, it's also given us a big opportunity. And it's up to us to make it count. I am running for governor again to think big and to be bold and to take the Commonwealth of Virginia to the next level and to lift up all Virginians. Over the next few months, I will be releasing several plans on how to build a stronger and fairer post-COVID economy by continuing the fight for civil rights and voting rights, attracting businesses and creating the best jobs and the raised wages, ensuring that all Virginians have access to affordable health care, and building a clean energy economy to address climate change. And we do need to address the issues of affordable housing that is affecting so many of our communities. But today, I'm proud to launch my campaign on the plan that I think is most important to every Virginian, and that is education. To build a strong post-COVID economy, the best workforce in the world, and to create a clear path for the middle class, we need to make an unprecedented investment in education. The time is now to ensure a world-class education for every single Virginia child. Our future and our children cannot wait.
And joining us now in Washington today is Mel Lanor of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Ms. Lanor, with former Governor McAuliffe entering the gubernatorial race again, what are his strengths?
State Senator, Senator Louise Lucas, I think, put it best today. She said pretty firmly, he is tested. He has already been the governor of Virginia, and I think he's going to rely on his record. He was a pretty popular governor, especially when it came to business creation here. And I think he's going to rely on his knowledge inside and out of the role to convince voters that he should be reelected.
And he is quite a prodigious fundraiser as well, isn't he?
He is. Even before formally entering the race, he already has far more than all of the other candidates combined.
And there are other Democratic candidates?
There are. Right now, there are three other candidates. Delegate Jennifer Carroll Foy of Prince William announced earlier this year in the spring. Senator Jennifer McClellan of Richmond, who's been a lawmaker in this area for 15 years, announced also in the spring. And Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, who got some national attention over sexual assault allegations, is also in the race. And then earlier this week, Delegate Lee Carter of Manassas filed paperwork to fundraise for a gubernatorial campaign. And so he has not yet formally announced, but it is expected that he will.
And now, why didn't Governor McAuliffe just run for reelection in Virginia?
Well, Virginia is a pretty interesting state in that governors can only serve one consecutive term. And so Governor Ralph Northam right now is nearing the end of his term as governor, and he would not be able to run for re-election, and so this gives McAuliffe the opportunity to do that. He, of course, preceded Governor Northam.
Now, are there any limits to how many single terms somebody can serve?
There are not, although it's pretty rare for a past governor to even serve two terms.
Now, what are some of the negatives 4 years after his gubernatorial term?
I think one of the biggest criticisms facing former Governor McAuliffe right now is that there are questions about whether his fundraising ability, his influence, and his talents would be better served supporting one of the candidates of color that's already in the race. All three of the declared candidates are African-American, and two are women. And if one of those two women were elected as governor of Virginia, they'd be the first Black female governor in the country. And, of course, all of this comes in a year where the country and the state, particularly here in Richmond, have been reckoning with the legacy of white supremacy and racism on power structures. And so I think there are questions about whether his time is up and whether it's now there is an opportunity for a new face that represents a different racial group to serve in that role.
And has the Democratic Party of Virginia and the Commonwealth itself changed over the past few years?
The state has certainly gotten more diverse, and I think that even the economic realities that face the state in the time that McAuliffe was governor are different now that we're faced with this pandemic and an economy that will be totally different than the one that he left behind.
What about on the Republican side?
There used to be two Republican candidates. One was Delegate Kirk Cox of Colonial Heights in the Richmond area, who was a former Speaker of the House. And the other was Senator Amanda Chase, also from the Richmond area. Republicans decided over the weekend that they would, instead of holding a primary, select their candidate for governor through a convention. And this really angered Senator Chase, who decided to run as an independent. And so now there is one declared candidate among the Republicans, and Senator Chase, who is now running as an independent. Very much in the mold of President Donald Trump.
Mel Lenore writes for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Thanks for the update on the governor's race in Virginia.
Thanks so much.
And we'll close tonight with three final news items. The Washington Post reports that the U.S. government and 48 attorneys general filed antitrust lawsuits against Facebook on Wednesday, seeking to break up the social networking giant over charges it engaged in illegal, anti-competitive tactics to buy, bully, or kill off its rivals. That's from the Washington Post. The twin lawsuits filed in federal district court allege that Facebook and its chief executive, Mark Zuckerberg, had behaved as an unlawful monopoly for years. And according to the Washington Times, Vice President Mike Pence on Wednesday announced that the Trump administration is redesignating two military bases in Florida for the Space Force. In a visit to Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, Mr. Pence announced that the historic base will be renamed Cape Canaveral Space Force Station and that Patrick Air Force Base will now become Patrick Space Force Base. And finally, Goya Foods has named Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as the Employee of the Month. The president of Goya said in a statement that when the New York Democrat called for a boycott of Goya products during the presidential campaign, sales soared. Well, that's it for Washington Today. If you've missed any of this program, you can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of your evening.